Good morning.
We're going to be getting the tests back starting this afternoon in a tutorial. Also, office hours, you can come to them. So, we'll see those. Today, I want to talk about, first off, the next assignment, which is which I put up Wednesday afternoon. The tutorial today is to do the first part of the assignment and tutorial, and then finish the rest of it by the end of Wednesday next week. So there's a little bit of programming on it, but not included. So I want to try covering the material that I want you to be able to understand in order to do stuff. So this is carrying on from No way.
That's probably the ball.
Okay, that's kind of annoying. I don't have any chalk.
Next door and see if there's
Oh, thank you. That would be very much appreciated. Let's see what's
Is there a pen that lets you like write on the screen?
Yeah, I can do that, but it's just very constraining. Thank you. Perfect. Okay. Yeah, I used to have to bring my chalk to class. I do that, but so file systems. So what you're going to do in the assignment for part of it is create and play with file systems. Now, there's a few concepts you have to have before this will kind of make sense. So a hard disk, as we talked about, there's this cylinders, head, sector kind of thing that they used to use for talking about parts of the hard disk. Nowadays, there's a computer embedded into the hard disk that abstracts that all away. And so the way you talk about storage in a hard disk as a linear array of blocks of some size, typically on the order of 4K. So you have these 4K blocks, and you have a really large array if you have like a terabyte, or 2 terabyte hard disk. So what do you want to do with this? Is we want to turn this into a system for holding files. So we want to put a file system on a hard disk. Now, the first thing to understand is that in general, you might want to put more than one file system on a hard disk. So you think of the hard disk as this big, long array of blocks, so 0 to N. And so you could put the file system put one file system on here. When I say put a file system, what I'm really talking about is a data structure. We'll talk about how that data structure is structured later, but like page tables and such, it's structured in terms of these fundamental units of blocks. So everything you want to have, every key data structure should be, in a sense, fit within a block or some multiple of blocks, so that can be read in and out at a unit, because you don't want to be accessing this thing arbitrary bytes. No. Into the blocks all have, so in the cylinders, head, sectors notation, the number of sectors a given cylinder has varies from how close in it is. Like, so one's really close might have like 50, and then you go further out, it might have 100 or something sectors. Probably may more than that actually in modern systems, but you don't care about that. That's below the level of our ability to program the system. That's
so right now,
Well, I'm saying it's always on all hard disks, the lowest unit of storage is fixed size. That's because doing it any other way is just too annoying. So, you know, it's divided up. The number of those units may vary in different parts of the disk, but the unit of storage has a base level. And because, you know, for programming purposes, why would you want a variable size one? I was drawing those sectors and things. So that's why I was saying it. So you have the hard disk. You know, if you're thinking about dividing into sectors or something, you normally think you just go do this sort of pie thing. But actually, what you do is you instead think of this as concentric circles, and then this one you'll divide into so many, and then this one you may do different lines, and then this one. But the idea is you divide this such a way so that every one of these spaces is equal size. Now, for some designs, actually what they'll do is they won't actually even be equal size, they'll just be equal storage. That's not very efficient, so normally you pack them in. But again, this is the structure of the hard disk itself, and given the fact that you can't ever, unless you go work for a hard disk manufacturer, you'll never see it. You won't see the structure of your hard disk. You'll just see this abstraction, which gives you this linear array of blocks. So I don't see a reason to specifically teach you about that. Also, the other kind of storage I want to talk about later, solid-state disks, don't have any spinning things. There is no cylinders or whatever. They are really a linear array of blocks. They have other weirdnesses that, again, are abstracted away, but we'll talk about that later. So that's one thing. The treatment in the book, I was a little disappointed because I couldn't find that much on solid-state disks. It's mostly about hard disks. And there is some stuff about log-structured file systems, which turns out are important for solid-state disks. But I didn't really see the coverage of solid-state disks. So I'm going to add that in as things. I don't know if I'll test you so much on that, but I'll try to give you some context. Back to what I was saying. So you have it's a hard disk, big array of blocks. First thing you should see in terms of structuring this is that there are partitions. When you talk about hard disk partitions, all you're doing is you're saying, I'm going to take this linear array and I'm going to divide it up. And just say, okay, partitions are always a contiguous range of blocks. But unless you're talking about something that's got an abstraction underneath you that allows you to have partitions being chunks all over the place, which does exist when you talk about things like LVM or something, but first approximation is a contiguous bunch of blocks. And so you put file systems in these ranges. So, for example, you might have ext4 on here, or you might have NTFS here. So, for Windows, you might have FAT32. Turns out there's all kinds of, we're not going to talk about that, we've also looked at, there's all kinds of file systems out there. Maybe this is a special recovery NTFS. You might have noticed with newer Windows installs, they don't actually come with, on older Windows boxes, you'd have all these floppies or CDs or DVDs storing, you know, your install media, which has the version of the operating system that came with your computer. And so if for some reason you mess up your system, you could always take those and reload everything. On modern computers, your systems typically do not come with such recovery media. Instead, they set aside part of the hard disk as a recovery partition. So it's the equivalent of saying, oh, look, here's, you know, all that media, it's on my hard disk. So this doesn't help if your hard disk dies, but it does help if your operating system gets corrupted for other reasons. So we have these different partitions, and in these different partitions are these different file systems. So these are on-disk persistent data structures that are used to store the key value mappings, which we call a file system. Partitions here, potentially different operating systems running in these different partitions. You know, this is when you talk about making a dual boot or triple boot system. You can do this because hard disk has been partitioned off. But how does this all get started? How do you know which operating system to load? You know, which gets control? Well, the BIOS is there, but what goes? But how does it know which to load? The bootloader.
Bootloader is typically at the beginning of the disk.
So when you say, so the classic x86 PC BIOS bootloader is one block in size, which was 512 bytes. And there was an 8086 machine language program in there, which is supposed to get the operating system up and running, and also contain the map of all the partitions also on the disk. All in 512 bytes. Kind of impressive. Let's just say it's a little constraining now. So there are all these hacks to make it so that you have a little program that loads the next program, that loads the next program. So you've heard of things like grub, or there's all these various boot managers. They have ways of taking that little bit of code and then having the rest of their program elsewhere on the disk, and they load themselves in stages, and then they're fully loaded. So that's the kind of PC BIOS approach to getting your system running. If you have a newer system, it doesn't do this. Instead, you have something else called EFI. Have you heard of EFI? So if you're trying to install Linux on a newer machine, you have to do with things like EFI. It makes things a little annoying. And the reason it makes things a little annoying is because this EFI stands for Extensible Firmware Interface. So firmware, the code that is built into your computer, even though you generally can upgrade it in some way, it's non-volatile. But EFI is much smarter than the PC, the old PC BIOS. Old PC BIOS, it would just know, oh, I've got a hard disk, what's my bootable hard disk? Let me read I know how to read the first block off that hard disk. And then I don't know what to do. I'll run it and see what happens. EFI understands the disk layout. It understands the disk layout to the point that it understands partitions. And it even understands, it can't even understand bits of file systems, depending on it. But basically, it understands partitions. It knows how, it has a standard way of booting an operating system from different partitions. So in fact, the boot manager you use is actually built into your computer. You basically tell it what operating system you want to load from which partition. Now, what's the annoying bit about this? Well, it turns out EFI in general has only been debugged and tested with Windows. So you try loading an alternative operating system, and some machines work right, and other machines are weird. Like, for example, I got this cheapo HP Touch laptop. So the small little thing, it's like 11-inch thing, it's $400, not fast at all, it's got slow AMD chip in it. But I thought I wanted something to play with Touch. I wasn't really going to buy a whole full laptop. It's nice to have something that I don't use normally. But this laptop, I partitioned it. So so when I say I partitioned it, what I mean is that it came with Windows on it. So the Windows partition took up the whole disk. And there are ways to make Linux run on top of those Windows partitions, but it's non-optimal.
So what you have to do is shrink it. So I have this NTFS might have been all the way here. I smushed it back down. And that's called resizing a partition. So I resized the partition. There's standard tools for doing this. Then I got my Ubuntu install on it, went into the rest of the disk. It did what it's want. It was all ready to run. And EFI never wants to boot it by default. If I just let the machine boot, it always boots into Windows. But if I hold down F9, in like the first like 2 seconds of it turning on, then I get the EFI boot manager. And when I get the EFI boot manager, I can then select Ubuntu. And then when I select Ubuntu, I get Grub. So I get a second boot manager. And then from there, I can boot Linux. Because there's an EFI Grub. What does Grub stand for? Universal Bootloader? Grand Unified, yes.
Sorry, I forget. Anyway, that sounds about right. But so it's kind of like it works, but kind of, and it's kind of clunky, and it's like, well, why don't you fix it? Well, it's in the firmware of the laptop. I can't upgrade that code very easily. It's not like it's documented. I would have to, yeah, I mean, if I mess with that, I'll probably make the system into a brick. So I'm stuck. So one thing to watch out for, if you want to install an alternative operating system onto a modern PC, check to find out how annoying its EFI bootloader is. Now, most of these EFI bootloaders, by the way, have a legacy mode. But the trouble is, if you put it into legacy mode, you often can't boot Windows. Which is why you work in Windows and get all that stuff. So we're in a little bit of a transition time. I suspect within the next 3 or 4, you know, a couple of years, it'll probably settle down and everything will work perfectly well. But right now, we're in those awkward technology transitions where things are just kind of annoying. Yes? Oh, well, I thought. Is that the right hand? Yes? UEFI? I've certainly seen UEFI in EFI. I think, as I recall, EFI is a standard from Intel. I'm not sure what UEFI is. I mean, I've seen them used interchangeably, is what I've seen, but I think there is a difference between them. I've only worked as EFI, but if anyone cares to look that up, let me know. There's, I mean, it's not a settled thing. Like, I know exactly how I know how the old PC BIOS works. That was nice and stable, and that worked the same. Couple of decades. EFI it's extensible. So what does that mean, extensible? It means everyone can do their own thing. And so, huh? Well, it means every motherboard manufacturer does what they want, and all they have to do is enough to get Windows 8 to boot. Once they get Windows 8 to boot, then they can go, oh, I'm done. And it doesn't matter if every other operating system you try booting on it now, it's going to be fighting it. It's like, you're supposed to be able to select what the default operating system is to load. And with this particular bootloader, it doesn't stick. You tell it a different one. There's a standard way of saying, oh, I actually want to boot this one by default and do this. Nope. Doesn't accept it. It keeps forgetting it every time it reboots. It accepts that you've marked the flag to say, oh, I want Linux to be the default thing to boot, but no, it won't remember it.
Thanks for your liars.
That's a separate thing. So, actually, related to that, there's all these things for trying to make sure you don't have malicious code running in your bootloader or running when you boot your operating system and stuff. This is known as trusted computing. You might have heard of. If people talk about secure boot, they're talking about this. If you're talking about a TCB, they're talking about. Well, that's trusted control based, but the whole idea of that, I'll just mention this in passing, I can talk about it more later if you want, but is that have some sort of digital signature on all the pieces that you have to load to boot an operating system. It's supposed to be a whole chain of things, like, okay, you have a good bootloader, you have a good you know, kernel for your operating system, like the libraries and stuff. You have all that signed, and then now we know exactly what version you have on there. So it's good for preventing malicious software from being installed in your system. It's even better for preventing software that the manufacturer of the computer did not want you to install. So this is the kind of thing that's used to make, say, iPhones not boot any code except that which is provided by Apple, because there's a very strong mechanisms that check the signatures of code when you turn on the phone. And in fact, an Android phones typically have this as well. They check the signature of the code that is loaded all the way up. When you unlock your Android phone in order to be able to boot, install things like CyanogenMod or something, how many of you install CyanogenMod? How many of you are on Android? Okay. Come on, if you play with Android, at some point you gotta try putting an alternative Android version on it. But when the first step of installing an alternative version of Android is called unlocking the bootloader. And when you unlock the bootloader, it's letting you run unauthorized versions of the code, which means you're basically disabling whatever protections it has and making sure that the integrity and authenticity of the code that you're booting here is correct. So to get what you want, you're kind of disabling some of the security mechanisms. When you jailbreak an iPhone, you're really disabling some security mechanisms that actually can protect you from rather nasty pieces of malware, such as the price of flexibility. That's why I can't say these mechanisms are completely evil. I think the Android one is generally better because most of the good Android phones allow you to unlock the bootloader so you can install other things. But some of them make it harder than others. The easiest ones are the Nexus phones because they're developer. Okay, that digression, you have these partitions, these different file systems. Is this the only way in which you can play with a new file system? Because what this would make it seem is that if I want to play with a new file system, I have to shrink existing partitions and write a low-level thing and potentially, you know, there's no fixed divisions between here. What's to prevent me from playing this, overwriting this one? Nothing except that hopefully I set the size of the partition right and I, you know, gave it the right commands and stuff. And so this is fundamentally dangerous. You mess with partitions and change them around, there's a good chance you will corrupt your partitions or your entire partition table and lose all the data on your desk. So you don't do this lightly. But I want you to play with file systems in the lab. How am I going to have a file system? Well, one thing is, you've got virtual machines. So in virtual machines, what you really do is you have all this thing that we call a hard disk isn't, of course, a full hard disk. It's a file. It's a file sitting on a host operating system. So what Linux thinks is its hard disk is to Windows. If you're running it in the lab, if you're running it on Windows or Mac OS or whatever underlying operating system you're running, that's just a file. It's a really big file, or maybe multiple files that are going to be kind of stitched together at runtime or something, but it's files. So what you have is there is a hard disk here with some partitions. So we'll call this one NTFS. And then in this here, in some range of blocks, is a smaller hard disk, which has, again, its own partition. And this is just a set of blocks here. Now, is this a contiguous set of blocks in NTFS? I think this is a nice linear array of blocks here. Could be. Probably isn't. Because that means you'd have to have this one big chunk. Remember, we always have to roll fragmentation. I mean, if this is on a file system that's mostly empty, sure. It'll be basically continuous. if it's been used at all and there's files kind of sitting in different places, then it won't be. It won't be contiguous. So this is a file, but at this level of abstraction, this is so you're doing all your work in the lab in a Linux virtual machine. I'm going to want you to play with file systems in that Linux virtual machine. But, well, if you mess with the file system partition here, you could also corrupt the Linux virtual machine. You won't mess up Windows, but you still could completely crash this one. So, you can do it again. You're going to make a file in your Linux partition that you will use to make a file system. Now, it turns out this file that you'll use to put a file system in it won't actually have the full structure. It won't have like a partition header. It won't have all the splits and stuff. It's just going to be a one file that will contain one file system. But again, it's just a data structure that requires a linear series of blocks. It doesn't matter where it is. And in fact, this will be a file that's in a virtual disk, which is in a file that's in a real hard disk. Just to give you an idea, if you're kind of getting confused, what are you actually doing? Yes, there's a couple of layers here. Okay. This is a file. It's got a file system. How do I access the files in it? Which gets actually us to a more basic question, which is, okay, I have a linear array of blocks. I stick a data structure in there, which is my key value store. But how do I actually use those keys and those values? And how do I use multiple file systems, combine them together? Like, for example, you may have a USB stick. You plug it into a computer. All of a sudden, those files now are accessible. They are now in your hierarchical key value store. Then you remove the USB stick, and those disappear. So there's a way somehow actually of taking multiple file systems and stitching them together so they all are accessible. So first, let's talk, what's the Windows way? What? No, we have not gotten to RAID. So I'll tell you right now, what is RAID? RAID is saying, I've got like five hard disks. And I want to take those five hard disks and make them look like one hard disk. And then have all, this would, if this was on a RAID array, this linear array of blocks would actually be provided by like five hard disks. And so there's a layer beneath it that's actually abstracting away and allowing them to basically spreading the data across. So that's what RAID does. But to a first approximation, a RAID array looks like one hard disk. Depends. You can do RAID in the motherboard can do RAID for you. That's called hardware RAID. Or the operating system can do it. And that's called software RAID. Both work. They are advantages and disadvantages. But either way, something has to provide code to take multiple physical disks and stitch them together so they look like one physical disk, which basically means that they're one linear array of blocks. And then once you have that one linear array of blocks, you can put a file system on it.
So, drivers?
Mm-hmm. Well, Windows, drive letter. C, D, E, F, A, E. Remember those? You all remember drive letters? What happens when you stick a CD in, or stick a DVD in? It typically shows up in drive D. And your main hard disk is drive C. Why is the main hard disk drive C? Right, C. Exactly. A and B were floppy disks. So C was the first hard disk. And then they went from there. Because you always had two floppy disks. Remember those pictures of the old IBM PCs with two big 5 1/4 inch floppy drives? A and B. It was very useful to have two floppy drives because then you could copy from one floppy to the other floppy. Have you ever tried copying a floppy disk when you only have one floppy drive? It's really annoying. It's called swapping floppies. Sometimes you have to swap them a lot.
So the Windows solution is to say that every file system that you can access gets its own drive letter. So Windows drive letter is and if you notice, when you have a single hard disk in your computer, you can actually have multiple drive letters. Like you'll have a drive letter for your main hard disk, and then you'll have another drive letter for your recovery partition. Or you might have another drive letter for your data partition, because they say, oh, you've got a terabyte hard disk. We're going to split it up and say, okay, you know, about 150 of it is your C drive, and then the rest of it's your D drive. A lot of systems come, or your E drive, a lot of systems come out of the box configured like this. So all that is that what they've done is there's some partitions here, and then they take the drive letters and they assign them. So as long as you're using a different drive letter, you're using a different file system. Kind of a I think you can actually get double letter drives. Yeah, I don't know. I think you can have double letter drives. It doesn't happen. And it turns out that for Unix type systems, you don't have drive letters. So you could call this is each drive letter is a tree of files. And so what you in effect get here is a forest. Each drive letter is a separate tree. Forest. With Unix-like systems, like Linux, you just have one tree. It's not a forest, there's no drive letters, it's just one tree. Always. No matter how many file systems you're integrating into the system, the files that you can access are only one tree. There is always one slash. And from there, paths are defined from there. So, where do you put the file systems? So we start with, we have a file system that becomes, so you have this initial root file system. When we say root file system, we mean root as in the root of the tree. Slash. We have C, bin, home, and these go on from there. So I've got one file system, that's my slash. Let's say I want to have a second file system. Where do I put it? How does it fit in there?
Another root inside your home.
What's another root? So I said there's only one root, there's only one slash. It's not like there's drive letters. It's like in Windows you could say C backslash and D backslash. And that's the root of the file system for those different file systems. No concept yet. There's just slash. Mounted. That's the thing. So there's this concept of mounting. So historically, what are you talking about by mounting?
USB in the slot?
No. Mounting a hard disk. Remember I said those hard disks with these big round platter things? So mounting a hard disk was, okay, there's this big metal spindle here. Let me pick up the big hard disk and stick it on there. And then, okay, now, you know, put it in place. Okay, we've mounted that drive pack. Okay, it's mounted. I mean, it's like literally mounting it on a spindle is what it is. So, you know, it's a ridiculous thing about the things are. We deal with storage, but that's where it comes from. So when you mount a file system, in a Unix system, if you have no file system mounted, you have to start with slash. Then that becomes everything. But then now, if I want to mount another file system, I already have slash. I don't want to get rid of slash. That would be bad, because then everything will get really confused. So instead, what you do is you take a directory that exists, and you mount on top of it. So classic Linux configuration is you have your home directory, which has all the user accounts, in a separate partition from your main operating system. So you'll have partition for slash, and you have a partition for home. So when you have this sort of arrangement, that means that after slash started, it will then mount home onto this directory. And so now all the files that will be under here, you know, such, you know what? These users' directories will then be under here. Now, if you're thinking about in terms of a tree, the slash of the home file system is actually right here. So in the home file system, there is these are top-level directories. But because we've mounted here, it's that entire subtree has been overlaid here. But if you're looking at this and overlaying a subtree on top of home, realize it's a potential problem. What if I already had stuff in home? What if I already had files? What if I already had directories? What happens to them when I mount them? Good news is they do not get erased. They're still there. But they are inaccessible. So home is known as a mount. A mount point is a directory where you mount a file system. Normally, mount points are an empty directory. They can't be a file, they have to be a directory. But normally, they should be an empty directory. But there's nothing that prevents you from mounting on top of a non-empty directory. And in fact, sometimes this is useful. But it can be a bit non-intuitive because you'll do these things of like trying to figure out where everything, oh, there's like, you know, 5 gigs of storage that I can't account for in my file system. Where is it? It's like, oh, you had it under a mount point. It's really like hiding it under your bed. You're never going to see it until you look underneath it. So you have to unmount the file system. What's there? So don't put data in a mount point. You'll be able to access it at all. Well, I take that back. If you had a file already open, you can still access it. But you can't access it like that. So what you're going to do in this lab is you're going to create a file system in a file and then mount it. Do you think regular users should be allowed to do this? In general, no. Because it completely changes what files can be accessed. I mean, you would just create a file system on disk, which gave you, you know, have all these weak binaries. You do all kinds of hanky-panky by having that file system and mounting it. Now, there are ways of doing, you can't just do it in an arbitrary place. But there are ways of mounting file systems safely as a regular user. Places, you can play with those, but the main thing you may want to do is use sudo for certain commands like mount. If you sudo file, then you can do it because root. Everyone knows what the root password is. When you sudo, usually the password for the student account in VM. Everyone know what the password is? It's student backwards with an exclamation point. The TNEDUTS exclamation point. That will be useful for you. Okay, and we are midway through. I will pause there before talking about the structure of file systems. Okay, let's get started.
So in this lab, as I said, you'll be creating a file system on its own, and then you'll be in a file, and then I asked you a question on how to access the files. So you're going to be having to mount it. You've got to figure out how to do that. And you then also have to do a few other things with it. So remember how we talked about this being a data structure. A file system is a data structure. It's a persistent data structure. And we have this issue that the persistent data structure can become corrupted. When it becomes corrupted, what do you do? Are you just dead? Come on. You've all seen this when you've turned off a computer unexpectedly, it's lost power and stuff, and then you turn it back on, it says, oh, I've got to check the file systems. Right? So what's the checker doing? It's walking the data structures. It's trying to make sure that the data structure is intact. So how could the data structure get messed up? Well, imagine, you know, it's a tree. What happens if you say you have pointers in the tree that point to something that isn't there? Or maybe you have two pointers that point to the same storage. So you've got, you know, overlaps in the tree or something. Basically, what if the tree is structure now is not correct? Well, that's the most dangerous thing with a file system, because if you start having things point all this way and that way, you're going to have a file system that when you start running data to it, you'll mess it up further. So the most important thing is to make sure your file system's state is always consistent. So file system checkers will go through that data structure and make sure everything is okay. Now, when you run a file system checker and there's been some errors, what you may have is things may seem to get worse. I mean, I've had these things where all of a sudden it says, oh, I'm now deleting 100 files. Yeah. Well, the reason why is because what it does is it finds, when it starts fixing this data structure, it may find that, oh, there's some sort of corruption. So let's say there's some corruption here. There's something wrong with this, isn't in the correct state. So it may have to blow this away because it can't be used. But now I've still got this entire, all this stuff here. What happens to it? It now has no place in the file system. So the only way it can be accessed is it has to be put somewhere where it can be accessed. Now we know where it's put. Lost and found. Files have been lost. And so if you want to find them again, so if you lost some files, you go to lost and found and you see if here it's really lost plus found. So you go to see, okay, there it is. And you can make sometimes if there's been major file system corruption, you'll find entire directories full of files. Sometimes you find individual files. When you start seeing things show up in lost and found, it's a bad sign. It means your file system was corrupted and the file system checker went through and tried to fix it as best it can. And had to do major surgery, cut things out. And whatever bits it could salvage, it sticks them in lost and found, and then you have to go put them where they belong. So, bad. So, the file system checker on Linux-like systems is called FSCK. File system checker, FS. Unfortunately, if you find yourself manually running FSCK,
you're not in good shape. So sometimes some people mangle this word into other less polite terms. So
you're running FSCK. FSCK understands the structure of this persistent data structure. It knows what the rules are, how it's supposed to fit together. But there's many different kinds of file systems. So for every different kind of file system, you need your own, needs its own file system checker. Right? So the convention is FSCK dot and the name of the type of file system. So ext or ntfs or something like that. It'll be the name of it there. And so if you just run FSCK, what we'll do is we'll try to figure out what the file system type is that you're trying to check and then invoke the appropriate FSCK program in order to check it. This matters because one of the things you'll do in the tutorial is deliberately corrupt a file system and then try to figure out and see if you can recover from it. Make it so that you can't mount it anymore. It'll seem like it's completely dead, and then you will bring it back to life. And that's because FSCK can do a lot of very important repairs. So why it can do repairs and why it can't do repairs. If you're going to make a data structure and you want it to be robust to corruption, how do you structure it? What do you do with it? What's one thing you really want it to have? You want some redundancy. You don't want to completely optimize for storage efficiency. You don't want to have it have only the bare minimum information. You want to waste a bit of storage to store multiple copies of the most important information that you'd want in the file system. So the more critical the information is, the more redundant it should be. So in a Unix file system, the data key will be divided into things like there'll be inode blocks, data blocks. I'll explain what an inode is in a little bit, but this is the key data structure. The data blocks are the ones that just store data. But then directory blocks. And then there's one other kind. The super block. Kind of a dramatic name, isn't it? Super block. So the data blocks store the contents of the file. The directory blocks store the directories. So this tells you what the names are. The inodes, it turns out directories actually store names to inode mappings. And the inodes have mappings to the data. Strictly speaking, you do not need the inodes. The inodes are a level of indirection between the directories and the data. You can't, in fact, there are file systems where you just have directories and the directories point directly to the data blocks. But in Unix file systems, they always have an inode in level of indirection, which fits in between these two. So really, you can say logically, it's like. And the reason it's in between is because it lets you do certain tricks that are very nice. So if you are familiar with the concept of hard links, this is one thing it lets you do. But really what this means is that the name of a file is separate from what the file actually is in terms of its contents and in terms of its metadata. But we'll
we'll talk about this more later. First, I want to talk about superblock, because you need to understand a little bit about superblocks to understand the tutorial. And that's, okay, you've got these other kinds of things. How do you know what the structure of the file system is? How do you know where things are? How do you know where the data blocks are? How do you know where the directories? How do you know where slash is? How do you know anything about what version it is? How do you know how big the file system is? All the metadata necessary for a file system to know what is this thing, like what range of blocks is it occupied? What's the block size of the file? That all requires a data structure for storing it. And if you don't know that information, you know nothing about the file system. That's a superblock. Basically, there's a set aside. A superblock is a block that is typically at the very beginning of the file system that encodes all the information about what the file system is like. You lose the superblock, you lose everything. You can't make head or tails of the file system at all. Sounds like a pretty important block, huh? So, what do you combine superblock with the idea of redundancy? What do you have? Backup superblocks. Turns out, on almost all Unix-like file systems, they don't just have the main superblock. They have multiple copies of the superblock spread throughout the file system. Because you need a superblock to understand the file system. So keep multiple copies of it. Yes, it wastes a little bit of space, but these superblocks aren't very big. You sort of scatter them there, and they're fixed offsets within the file system. There are these standard places that it will tend to put backup superblocks. So if any of them get blown away, they can always be regenerated. And so one of the things FSCK does is it goes and checks the consistency of the superblocks, and if any of them have been corrupted, it'll recopy them, regenerate them. So this is the kind of things you do with an on-disk persistent data structure that you don't normally do in RAM. Is you plan for disaster. The disasters that you don't expect to happen almost ever. But they happen. And that's what's going to save. Is that plan? And good file systems do this not. I mean, the superblock's the easiest place to see this, but they have little bits of redundancy all over the place. Like, for example, they don't just have single directional pointers. Normally, pointers are like, go both ways, or they're redundantly encoded and stuff, so that if you lose one of them, you have other ones to figure out what was supposed to be there. If you don't have that redundancy in the structuring of this, you can't do recovery in a meaningful way. All you can do is check it and then say, oh, look, it's corrupted. Erase it and start again. And you're talking about multi-gigabytes of stuff that's an answer you'd never want to hear. So instead, it says, okay, it's corrupted. Let me see if I can salvage this. So you know you're not supposed to just pull the plug on your computer, right? Computers in general do not like it when you just yank power from them. Often when you turn them back on, they complain, they say, what happened? Unclean shutdowns are bad. Know enough now. It was a little bit of information, but you should potentially put that together. Why that's such a big deal. So the file system has to be, you want to keep the file system in a consistent state. When using a computer normally, is the file system in a completely consistent state all the time? No. Remember, file system's slow. You know, that file system is not slow. process and this is data structure. Hard disks are slow. So if you kept the data structure on disk fully consistent all the time, it means that you would always be having to do operations at the speed of the disk. That's bad. So what do we do instead? Copy it into RAM. We copy bits of the file system, and we do all the operations in RAM. Most of the things you're doing with file operations are actually file operations on cached copies of the file that are being, all the operations are being done completely in RAM. And then later on, they're written to disk. Exactly. You lose that copy. Now, there's various ways. You might notice newer computers are much better at dealing with unclean shutdowns than older computers. And it turns out that's because, well, I'll explain it to you. They have certain tricks they do to make this work. But the main thing to realize is that the way standard operating systems work is fundamentally unsafe, in that they cache a bunch of information in RAM. It's not written directly to disk into this data structure. It's not fully updated. So you could potentially corrupt it if you just pull the plug. And you have, and so then you have to, okay, but we left the, we only up, you know, we wrote this file, we only kind of updated it partially. We didn't add the pointer here, we do things. And so if you lost things in the middle, then you had to come back and say, okay, where were we? Put that there. You might have to basically throw away all the partially written information you had put in there because it isn't a consistent state. In order to get a consistent state, you have to undo what you did. So this is bad. Have you all heard of journal file systems? When you see operating systems, somebody say, is this file system journaled or not? The funny thing about journal file systems, well, so the journal file systems make this problem of the unclean shutdown much, much less severe. But it does so by writing everything you do to disk twice. What? Why are you writing to disk twice? Well, there's a certain, some kind of writes that are fast and other kinds of writes that are slow. Now, if I'm writing to a big data structure, I'm potentially bouncing it all over the place in the hard disk. Lots of seeds. That's not so good. That's going to be kind of slow. But there is a kind of write I can do that will is guaranteed to be as fast as possible. If I just write linear, if I just stream out the writes one after the other, it can actually be quite fast. So what you do on a journaled file system is you don't directly update, you know, the pointers to the data blocks and other things. You write to a journal, which means it's just a linear thing where you just say, well, update block 14. You know, block 14 now is part of this file, and block, you know, 727 million is part of the, is this role. It has this context and stuff. You just write this record to the journal, streaming it out to disk continuously, saying what you're going to do. And then later, and only after it's been written out to disk, you go back and actually change the on-disk data structure. Basically, you're taking notes for yourself of things to do with the file system. And then you go through and do the update. And then you mark them as, okay, I've already done this update. So when you have an unclean shutdown, all you have to do is go to the journal and replay the journal. You go through the journal and see, oh, what entries haven't been handled. Go through and handle those. Now your file system is all set. Because you always write something to the journal first before, you know, the state of the disk is such that whatever is in the file system plus the notes that you had together means that, okay, it's consistent data structure. It's not primitive instructions, but it's an encoded format of saying the operations that are going to happen with the file. It's not a program, but it's instructions.
Doesn't that kill the durability of your hard drive, having something constantly write to it?
That's the hard disk controller. I really, it's like, with normal hard disk, you don't worry about writing to certain parts of the hard disk.
really isn't an issue with conventional hard disks. Their durability is quite high. The solid state disk is a problem, but they have ways to deal with it. We'll talk about this more. This is a lot of information to kind of get your head around. But the main thing to understand is there's this complex data structure that makes up a file system. We'll be talking more detail how this is structured later. But this is not all done. Operations to it are not all done on disk. They're done first in RAM. And if you had to keep the stuff in RAM always completely updated the disk as it should be, you would be running much slower. So mostly things are done in memory, it's cached there, and then to make sure the disk is updated in a timely fashion, it's updated in the journal. And then later on, it'll be updated in the rest of the data structure. Because the journal is a limited size, you might write for a while and then say, oh, we've run out of space in the journal, okay, stop everything, let's clean the journal, let's actually apply all the changes we were supposed to do, and then so you might notice that writing twice might seem like a really bad idea, and it is if your workload is dominated by writes. But most of the time in a file system, we do reads. The writes are fewer and far between. So it works out for standard workstation workloads. If you have a workload that is mostly writing to disk, you need a different kind of file system. You do not use a journal. Inodes. Let's talk about inodes. Yes? Swap area, yes. Swap area is actually this is that's a good time to talk about. So the journals, all this record of changes that you made to disk, it's not a nicely ordered tree, it's more this linear data structure that's stored out. When people talk about a swap area, what is that? That's kind of like a journal. Well, it can be structured in a couple of different ways, but it's just the place where you run out of RAM, you dump data to disk. So let's say you need to free up memory. You have some pages. You need to make room for something. What do you do with that? Well, if you can throw it away, you throw it away. Maybe it's some information you kept around in case you might need it later. It's cached. You free that. But at some point, you do all the freeing you can, and you find out, no, actually, I really have to get this out of here, and it's not stored anywhere else. That's what the swap area is for. It's a partition. On a Linux system, it's a partition. On a Windows system, typically, instead of being a partition, it's a big file, which might as well be a partition. But it's just a big file. You've just taken, just like I did with a Linux VM in there, you just make this really big file. Linux systems can do that as well, but normally what they do is they want their own separate file. When you start writing the swap, you slow things down. Definitely. But what often happens is you just have some things in memory that you aren't actively using. And so kicking them out of memory may take a little bit of time, but then once it's done, you don't need it again, so it can just stay on disk and you can just move on. Think of it like that pile of papers that you've been meaning to get to and you haven't gotten to for a while. You can't throw it away. You need to put it aside. So it's like you use this. Exactly. If it's being actively accessed, you have to, of course, keep it in RAM. If you're not actively using it, but it doesn't, you don't have, it's still a program that is running, it's just sleeping, you put it in the swap area. That's why a program can be swapped out. And then when you start running it again, you'll have to wait for it to come off disk. Now, of course, the way it normally is done is the whole program doesn't go to disk, it's part of it. But the parts of it that you don't, that you need, have to be loaded in. This is how you see your computer sometimes if you've been just turning it on, it wakes up from sleep a lot. What sleeping a computer often means is writing in everything in RAM to swap. So then you can power it on. So when you turn it back on, it reads in everything to swap into memory.
and that takes some time. It all depends on whether you're doing suspend versus hide. Suspend means you're keeping power to RAM. And so when you come back from sleep, you can just, things are all there. If you go into hibernate, RAM is going to be powered off. And so you write it all to disk. Swap or swap. No, it's a partition of the hard disk, but it's a separate partition. So a Linux system will typically have a main file system and then a separate partition that'll be marked as Linux swap. For Windows, they do it as one partition. They don't do it separately, but they have a really big file that's allocated. That's the swap partition. That acts like a swap partition. It's a swap.
So swap is
why not just write it as a regular file?
Yeah.
Well, the idea is I want to store it in a nice way that I can stream it back in. Right, exactly. And when you want to bring it in, you want to bring it in fast. So it structures the swap area so that when you want to read from it, it just goes and suck it in. You don't want to do random access. But the main thing is it's not a file system. It's not being stored. You can put it in a file system, but logically it's part of virtual memory. It's an extension. It's essentially more pages.
But they're all contiguous.
Well, they might be trying to they try to organize it so that when they get loaded in, they'll be contiguous. But they won't necessarily. It may be fragmented. On modern systems, if you're accessing swap, your system's just going to be way, way slow. And in fact, if you talk about a lot of Unix-like systems, i.e. all your smartphones and tablets and such, they have no swap. There is no swap for Android. There is no swap for iOS. Because it turns out that it takes a lot of power to write stuff to flash RAM, and then you read it back in, and it also does extra wear and tear and stuff. So what's the solution on a mobile operating system?
Keep all memory.
You just kill them. You just terminate the process. You've seen this. If you start multitasking a lot on a mobile on a mobile platform, you'll notice that certain apps have very clearly been terminated and are starting up from scratch. When you switch back, they were knocked out. And the whole design of their APIs and stuff, you're supposed to make your program so that even after it's been starting up from scratch, if you wanted to save any state so it's come back to a certain thing, you have to do that yourself. But yeah, if you've been kicked out, you've been kicked out. So it just is a very aggressive about terminating programs that are taking up space and resources. On a classic workstation, you don't want that to happen because you'd lose lots of space. On a mobile platform, they encode the APIs and the program that they built from the start and say, you're going to die at any time. Deal. And what are most of those programs doing? They're accessing things from the cloud. So all the persistent storage is off somewhere else. So who cares if this thing dies? Just restart. I can log back in. Big deal. If you're playing a game and you switch out of it and switch back in, you kind of hope it's safe in place. But again, that's a game program. What? If you're running Linux with Android on it, you don't need it. If you're running Linux with a regular workload, you want to swap it. Because otherwise, the kernel will make sure things happen, but that means it will start randomly killing processes. So you'll get this point. You're like, oh, I'm surfing the web. I've got my word processor going. You start up a game. All of a sudden, your word processor got killed. Like, you're right around the game, so I had to kill the word processor. Oops, you forgot to save. Desktop applications do not deal well with just being killed randomly. They haven't been designed that way. The only reason why mobile applications can get away with it is because that was the assumption from the get-go. Hmm.
No, it's you're not running multiple things at once. It's just that there will be CPU and memory pressure. And that at any time, your program has to be ready to be
terminated. Basically, I was just saying, as soon as you get tied, or as soon as your process goes in the background, save everything.
Yeah. Well, save exactly. Save, maybe not save everything, but save what you can't afford. You have a lot of RAM, then you're fine. That's the nice thing about the lot of RAM. Because again, the applications have to be designed. Let's say you're running a flagship Android phone with like 3 gigs of RAM. What have these applications been optimized for? For phones that have maybe a gig or half a gig. So if you're running with 3 gigs of RAM and you're running programs that expect to be able to do well in half a gig of RAM, no, you're not going to run into low memory situations. Now, notice this is actually a strategy that Apple has employed very aggressively. So the very oldest iOS devices that are still being supported, like 4S or something, they have like 512 megs. But almost everything after that has a gig of RAM. So like the iPhone 5, the 5S, the 6, the 6S, all those phones all have 1 gig of RAM. And similarly, the iPad all have 1 gig of RAM. The only thing that gets more RAM is the latest iPad Air. The iPad Air 2 has 2 gigs. Everything else has 1. Now, why did Apple keep this? You could say to save costs. And that is part of it. But also part of it is that, you know, everyone's gotten used to working with that much RAM. And if you start making some devices have much more RAM, developers get lazy. They stop planning for their applications to be terminator. They start becoming piggish with the amount of RAM they use. And so then now all of a sudden these programs won't work on the older devices, and they want to keep those older devices viable. So it's actually a deliberate strategy that they're not just increasing RAM willy-nilly. Now watch it now. Now if the iPad Air 2 has gotten 2 gigs of RAM, the iPhone 7... we'll have 2 gigs. Next generation. Now they'll start standardizing on 2 gigs of RAM, and then they'll do that across their line, and then that'll be easier. But they are very slow with these things because they know once you commit to having more space, developers will take advantage of it. And it will make older devices much harder to use. But now this should also be explained why your web browser crashes on a mobile device if you have too many tabs open. Because you've taken up too much RAM, and the operating system goes, pow! You did too much. Anyway, so I will try explaining iNodes now. You don't really need that for this particular lab, except for one thing to understand, is that storage of any file is taken up in the number of blocks. So this is important. So, and it turns out Unix systems have a little bit of a trick. That you can, let's say you have a file that has a big range of zeros in it. Why store space for them? So it is possible to make files that have holes in them. When they say they have holes in them, that's just space that's not allocated to the file. So you can have something that you can have a 1 gig file on disk that takes up no space on disk because it's all zeros. And so why allocate data to it? It's just a zero. Just keep track of, well, it's all zeros. If you start actually changing the file and doing things, then it will allocate storage for it. You'll see this. See you next week. Or see you this afternoon.